Well, good evening, and a very warm welcome, one and all, to Dr. Rock's radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com. Bit of an election special intro there, kicking off with Monty Python's Flying Circus Live at Drury Lane version of their election night special, followed by, Elected, of course, by Alice Cooper, UK Subs, and Coalition Blues, and then Tracy Curtis, Don't Sit Silently While Governments Take What Belongs to Us. And that is basically about all I've got to say on the matter. I'm sure you'll be grateful to hear. I've got a fine guest on tonight, a man called Stuart Ferraris, who is an holistic dentist. As many of you will know, I've been managing most of my healthcare, or nearly all of it, in fact, using complementary or holistic means of one way or another for many. Damn that mute button. But this is the first time I've come across an holistic dentist. Would have been very useful if I'd come across one earlier. I do seem to be having a little bit of trouble with my Skype, so I'm going to have to put another tune on whilst I try and get hold of him. It's always so much fun, isn't it? But before I put on Molly Hatchet and Boogie No More, I'm going to put out a shout for Fairport, who is, of course, Pat's companion on Scotland Is Free on Monday nights, who's had a bit of a setback, but apparently he's pretty well. They've discovered that that things are not so serious as they might have been, and it is, as they say, treatable. I'm not sure that the kick Laurie's going to give him up the arse is going to be treatable, but hey, we'll just have to wait and see. So here's some Molly Hatchet whilst I try and round up my guest, and I should be back with you in 5 or 6 minutes or so with Stuart, if everything goes according to plan. There you go, that was Money for Nothing from Dire Straits, and you're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on peoplesinternetradio.com, and I am now joined on the line by tonight's guest, Stuart Ferraris. Can you still hear me now that we're live, Stuart? Very good. Oh, hang on a moment. There we go. I need to press that button. That's better. Now the audience will be able to hear you as well. So thanks very much for joining us. I really do appreciate you making the time. It's my first chance to talk to an holistic dentist, so I'm quite looking forward to it. How did you get into it? What's the story of got you into dentistry, and how did it all start for you?
Possibly because of various dentists in my life as a kid. The first dentist, the family dentist, and he was interested in trying new things, and I became a guinea pig because my dad couldn't really afford orthodontics, so he offered a reduction in cost just so that he could use me as a practicing tool, as it were, you know. But he said he would be, you know, avoid any catastrophes. Anyway, he did that, and then of course I acquired a stepfather later on, who was a dentist. So I did more and more of that, and thought, well, it's actually a very interesting area of work, and I think that it's very difficult to go into dentistry if you haven't had some broadside with the profession, because it's not necessarily a well-known profession, and most people think that dentists aren't that nice, really, I suppose, so therefore they think they want to be in a profession where they're not liked. And I'm sure that people that go into dentistry have a little quest to be liked, so they make it really hard for themselves. So if people do like them eventually, they must really be liked, you know. So there might be all that kind of psychology involved in it. But anyway, I did. And I got a bursary to go and study in Cape Town, the undergraduate process to get qualified as a dentist. And I did so. And then after that, we had obligatory national service in South Africa. So I wheedled my way into the Navy. And stayed there for 2.5 years until I was exempt from national service. During that time, I used the time to expand my knowledge and experience in dentistry, but also start a practice of my own upcountry. I acquired a pilot's license so I could fly up on weekends to work there, and then in between all that, I started building a boat, a 45-foot sailing boat, and I was privileged to be able to use the area around the wardroom. That's where Navy officers lived. And so I acquired two garages, and moved the hull in there once I had that made, and started building it. And so as soon as I left the Navy, I had finished the boat so that I could put it in the water, and then continued to finish it while I was practicing up country, coming back for I would work a 3-day week, probably come back for 4 and work on the boat, travel in between, have a good life. And then about 4 years after qualifying, or 4.5 years, I sold up everything and headed out of Cape Town for into the South Atlantic. First stop, St. Helena, and the next stop was Rio de Janeiro.
Well, that's really exciting. It sounds like, did you have any time to sleep in those early years? It sounds like you were very busy.
Yeah, no, I must admit that, sleep was something that was a privilege in between. And of course, you've got the energy of youth and determination, all those things. So, but I did graft a lot. I was probably wore myself out a little bit because I was not only having to keep the Navy job up, but my private practice and all the time building the boat. So I would work evenings, and then I'd give myself off trips into the country and stuff like that, occasionally climbing the mountains and stuff. And then I would also have Sunday evenings off, where I'd go and sit in a pub in Weinberg, and a band called Blacksmith played all these nice jiggly tunes, and you could really have a sing-along and a few pints, and then the week would start again.
Yeah, it's good to get just a bit of a break in between all of that stuff, I thought.
Absolutely. Necessary.
Yeah. So where did your boat trip end up? How many places did you go to? And I gather from our earlier talk that you actually had a little bit of a dental surgery on the boat as well.
Yes, it was a portable unit which tucked away like everything else. And a boat is an incredible unit to be in because it has to have everything you need. So it's not only the mechanisms for running the boat, and we store the sails and everything like that, but it's got to have stores from water to fuel and food and all the equipment to for fishing, for going for a little boat ride. You have windsurfers, you name it. The place is like a storeroom of goodies. And tucked away, I had my portable dental kit, so I could open that out and run a little Yamaha generator on the deck that ran it. So I had suction and compressed air. And then I would lower the saloon table that came out and put some foam rubber on that, and that would be my dental chair. So the patient would lie on the table, and you could work. It was fantastic, and I did some interesting jobs in exotic places, islands, both for fellow travelers and for locals. One of the most exciting times was in southern Grenada, where I landed, and they didn't have dentists. In those days, they had a mission dentist that came from time to time. So this little lad had an abscess in the front tooth, so normally it would be extracted. So I was able to do a root canal treatment on it and save it. And, of course, we had come in this little port on the south, and I was still flying a South African flag. So they said, actually, if you went around to the capital, you may not be graciously accepted there. So you just stay here, and we'll look after you. And they provided us with food and all kinds of provisions, and took us all around the island to show us the place. So, yeah, you get perks from all these little things that you can give back to the community, things that they find valuable. So it was fantastic. And fellow sailors who had teeth knocked out, I could make provisional things to fill gaps. So, yeah, you can, it's lovely. Suddenly you realize are valuable when you need them.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, it seems to be a great skill to be carrying around, because a bit like being a gardener, really. I shouldn't imagine you're ever short of work.
Especially in places like that,
Yeah.
even in the Caribbean, obviously people, the fellow sailors particularly loved having their teeth cleaned, and they paid good money for it, you see. So we earned pocket money, which is great, because when you're traveling, you're traveling on your capital. And when I stopped in Rio, I stopped there for about 9 months, traveling through South America and sailing around Rio and down south around the islands there. It was fantastic, all kinds of experiences, of course. And then I left the boat in Rio over the first Christmas and flew overland, or traveled overland, so over South America, right up to Bolivia and Peru, and then flew to the UK, did a locum in Gillingham, Kent, and that helped to bring in some cash so I could buy yacht fittings, because what I found in South Africa, there's always wind and the temperature is Mediterranean down in Cape Town, but on the sea it's quite coolish, but it's not humid. But when you're in places like Rio and the Caribbean, it can get quite humid. So I wanted to make more portholes in the boat. And but you have to make them water tight, so you have to get the real thing. So at the boat show, I could buy all these bits and pieces from the work I did and get back to Rio and then sail up from there to the Caribbean, explore the Caribbean, and then eventually the first daughter came along. So flew back to the UK. She was born, and then the mother didn't want to go back to the boat. So I went back to the Caribbean and sailed the boat back via Bermuda to the UK, and that's where I've been until, well, I was at the boat was here for a year before I had the gas explosion that turned me into an astronaut with dire consequences. You know, I wasn't torn apart. Well, I was torn apart, but I survived.
So you were on the boat when it blew up.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, luckily on my own, because I'm quite a good survivor. But other people probably wouldn't have quite made it. But there was a lot of luck, because I was several hundred yards from the regional hospital. They had just cancelled an operation where they'd had 30 pints of blood for this orthopedic operation, but it happened to be my blood, my blood group, you know, and they had a whole lot of surgeons on tap because they were in changeover. So the two of them that were going on holiday had another two to replace them. So there were four that could stand over me and fix up all the little bits that were broken and messed up. And
I suppose it was quite a big cloud, but it had a silver lining then by the sound of it. How long did it take you to recover from that?
Well, I was in intensive care for a month because they thought I was going to depart, because unfortunately both my ankles were severely crushed from the impact underneath, and legs broken, arms broken, ribs all broken, smashed face. But it took a week to realize that my stomach was wedged between my lungs. I blew my stomach through my diaphragm. But there were so many other problems that they didn't actually realize that until they realized I wasn't absorbing food, and they found that my stomach was getting a bit gangrenous. But anyway, that all recovered. And then, but at the end of the month, they realized that I wanted to live. So they put me into the accident unit for another 2 months, and so 3 months later, I mean, after 2 months, I was out. And then it took me about 9 months to rehabilitate, to get back to work again.
And all of that happened in North Wales, did it?
That's right, about 30 years ago. So
that's how long ago you were sailing the briny, as it were. Do you think it'd be, as a matter of interest, do you think it'd be as easy to do that now, to build yourself a boat and take off around the world?
Well, I think you could build a boat, but you need the enthusiasm. You know, it's a hell of a job. I mean, I did it in record time. I've always been a fairly determined person, but I think probably now, if I acquired a boat, I would buy it, because building requires a tremendous commitment of energy, and it's quite stressful.
Yeah. So,
But my wife and I are probably going to just charter boats because I've done that. It's easier than owning your own boat because you can go to many different places without having to trans oceans. You know?
Yeah.
To kit out a boat. Yes, you can do it these days, but I think that you would only find it easy to work in third world countries because our modern creatures are very sensitized by this concept of cross infection, etc. So I'm not sure. You know, I mean, I know that you can get, even in the boat, you can get things pretty hygienic and all the rest of it. But you know, when you're used to the real kind of modern stuff, I never thought about it when I was doing it 50 years ago because I obviously had very high tech equipment in Cape Town, and then going for this little bit. But I had worked in mission hospitals in deeper Africa where things were so rudimentary and basic. So I'd seen quite the spectrum of dental care. So for me, it was just an in-between delivery. And I didn't think very much of it, and nobody questioned it, I suppose, because they wanted the treatment.
Yeah, yes, indeed. Well, a friend of mine has just spent time building and putting on, just on a canal, a boat in England, and the amount of hassle he's had with all of the various agencies and licensing authorities and people wanting to check the fuel system and the water system and the gas system and the water tightness, and he's not allowed to sell it for 3 years after he's got it on the water. And I was amazed. It's actually taken him longer to get through all the administration than it took him to put the boat together. So I can't imagine what it'd be like doing it for something that's going to travel from country to country.
Yeah, well, I did do. This is why I think about it, because in the profession, we've had an escalation of bureaucracy that is absolutely amazing. And of course, they say it's looking after the patient, and there's all these regulations that come in where we've got to get consent and authority the charges that we make. But I don't know that any consent has been received from patients to say that they are happy to pay for all this bureaucracy, because obviously somebody has to pay for it, and dentists become the tax collectors because all these bureaucrats make levies on the profession, and so it has to trickle down into the fees that patients pay, and if it's NHS, then of course the taxpayer pays. So one way or the other. So I think that if they realized how much of dental costs were involved in paying for bureaucrats, they would possibly not be that excited about it and maybe raise more arguments about it. And that's come in as well, where you're restricted and restricted, and I think that they almost want robots to do the job. Because I've been recently told not to use homeopathic potions when I was actually using nutrition. So they don't even know the difference. And they don't want chiropractic associated with industry. And of course, it's fantastically important in treating facial pain. And so, but the ignorance is actually rife, with more bureaucracy, it seems that ignorance seems to blossom because people are so tightly encased in their linear thinking that there's no wider spectrum of thought. Anyway, it's a very...
Do you think it is just ignorance? Because it does... I'm more familiar with other forms of complementary healthcare, and it seems to me that there is actually a specific aim of kind of shutting it all down and leaving us only with orthodoxy.
I think that's a very simple question. That is the case. But you know, what is the motivation? I can understand from the, you know, from big pharma that they don't want competition. But you know, the competition is actually minute compared to, say, other pharmaceutical companies. So, but I think, you know, a colleague that we studied homeopathy together, and but I was also interested in nutrition for very many reasons, but and I was, you know, using it in helping people get healthy so that they would have healthy gums and etc. It's a big aspect of health. You can't have you know, give nutrition for hearts and not expect it to be beneficial to oral tissues. Anyway, that's another subject as well. But the point is that I was individualizing or personalizing the nutrition that I was giving to patients using things like kinesiology, etc., and also history taking and finding out about their lives and what possibly was needed for them specifically. And my colleague said, well, can't you just have like a package of three or four nutrition, you know, traditional supplements? That would be just easy and just give it to them. And of course, that's the modern doctor talking, that really wants something prescriptive, something easy. You know, they don't want to think about individualization because it's complex. So medicine for drugs and modern medicine is very much mass oriented. It's the average person is treated. And so as soon as you start trying to do individual treatments or treat people individually, and especially in a holistic way, then it becomes very, very complex, very demanding on cranial capacity. It's fatiguing. People are complex, and it's tiring. And it's also frustrating because you can see what people need, and if the people aren't on the same wavelength, they resort back to modern sort of orthodox medicine because it's easier for them too. So it's not just practitioners, it's the public. You know, it's like the public scream for antibiotics. They scream for this, they scream for that. And of course, these drugs are very useful, but they are also very dangerous for chronic problems that manifest later on. And that's another huge subject, because of what these things affect other complex functions in the body.
Yeah, so you find the, I mean, my impression is that general practice doesn't know a lot about nutrition and hydration. I've learned a lot more since I moved away from that. But you're finding that your patients are actually resistant to the advice you're trying to give them. How do they respond when you introduce them to something like kinesiology, which I think is a really fabulous tool?
Well, yes, no. I mean, you know, obviously I've got a lovely practice and the majority are on board. It's just that every now and again, you know, obviously when I was a lot younger, I was very enthusiastic and I wanted everybody to be healthy and have knowledge. So I was out there like an evangelist, you know, terrifying, actually. All evangelists are terrifying. because, you know, it becomes so passionate that it's overwhelming and it's not necessarily sensitive to how quickly or sort of at to what level people want. So you eventually have to understand that if somebody wants something, they'll ask for it. Yes, you can inform them, but you have to do the information almost passively and leave it there and let the seed grow. And if it grows and it asks for nourishment from you, then you give it. But that's a thing called maturity. It takes time for that. But the trouble is that along the way you get a bit disillusioned as well because people generally are lazy. They don't want to take responsibility for themselves, get involved, go through a long-term dietary changes, lifestyle changes. But, you know, going back to what you said about kinesiology, when I started here and I and I try to introduce chiropractors into patients' lives. They didn't even know how to say it. And that was probably because I was in North Wales, and when I arrived here, they didn't even know what salad was. But, I mean, it was a bit like that. It was very, very parochial.
It is quite a resistant population. I spent 6 months or so living up there and felt more like I was in a foreign land than anywhere I've ever been.
Yeah, but, you know, it's changed dramatically. I mean, the A55, I think, had dramatic changes. And, of course, if you reflect on how communication has changed the world, how people have access to information through the web, etc., like in your program, you know, so people can get much broader views. So even in very parochial, out of the way places, people are being exposed to much wider knowledge and experience. It's just absolutely the world abounds with knowledge. Sometimes that in itself is dangerous because people get onto the internet and they come to me with all this internet knowledge, and of course it's biblical. You know, it's said it on the web, so it must be true. And that can be frightening too, because they start believing that they can have what's there. You know, people arrive and they want their fillings out so their teeth can grow whole again, you know, because they've seen that this can be done and it happens. And I probably haven't searched enough to find out how they believed what they read, because there's things called arrested caries when you haven't damaged the structure of the existing tooth. So some decay has taken place, what is called demineralization, but you haven't disturb the foundational structure, you know, the reinforcing, as it were. There's not much fiber in an enamel of a tooth, but there's enough so that the enamel, calcium can form hydroxyapatite crystals, but they need some structure to go in it. And provided you haven't damaged that too much, then minerals can come in from the mouth, from the saliva, from the food you eat, and remineralize. It often doesn't look attractive because pigments come in as well, so you get little dark areas. But it's hard and it's functional, and in the past people drilled that out because they thought it was rotting tooth. And so then they introduced man-made materials, which are disastrous, really. They're fantastic if you need to patch up a tooth and to mend it, but it's not as good as the real thing. So if you can preserve the teeth as they are, that's fine. But once you've drilled out a big chunk of it, unfortunately, we haven't got the technology to make that grow back. 20-odd years ago, I listened to a lecture from an American. They were just on the threshold of introducing what was almost like stem cells that would grow, and then they would kind of chop them off when they got to the top of the tooth, reshape them, and that would be it. But unfortunately, it's one thing doing it in a test tube, it's another thing doing it in the mouth.
Because everybody, as you said, is different?
Well, it's different, but you're also eating. There's saliva, there's germs, there's God knows what else. So these cells don't really like to do. See, our enamel is formed under the gum before our teeth erupt. So it's in a lovely, undisturbed environment before it enters the real world. So the mouth is quite a violent area, and that's why it's so scary with mercury fillings being introduced into it. It was a wonderful material, and it was useful in its time, but it was like lead pipes that were used in Rome that made all the Romans a bit doolally, especially the higher echelons, because lead is toxic, heavy metal, and it hasn't been too good for us in the early centuries. When I moved in here and I did up houses, of course, I was still pulling out lead piping. So, it wasn't that long ago that we were having our water running through lead pipes as well. And so it's not great having that sort of heavy metal. And then in the mouth, it's one thing in a water channel where water is actually not that chemically active, but in a mouth where you've got all sorts of acids, alkalis, different chemicals from different foods, it's violently chemically reactive. So when you have different metals of different electrical potentials, you have a lot of corrosion happening, and it corrodes on one, like the anode in a boat. So it moves from anode to cathode, so from negative to positive. So you end up by getting a lot of erosion, so a lot of mercury and silver and other things come out of the mercury filling. And if you have a gold filling, that becomes quite dull because a lot of the silver ends up being deposited on the gold because the mouth becomes a battery. Mm-hmm. Saliva is the electrolyte that, like you've got in your car battery, is the water, sort of acid in the battery between the different poles. You know? So yeah, so it's no wonder that people get mercury into their bodies if they've got mercury fillings. And people come to me regularly because they know that I don't use mercury and that I know how to take out mercury fillings as safely as you can take them out. And but they often come because they've looked on the internet and they found how miracles can happen when you take these things out. And there are white boys even in the profession that, well, they probably believe it maybe, because they've been told this happens. And so people are a little bit misled because, yes, there probably are the odd miracle where somebody was very susceptible to the mercury heavy metal toxicity, and you take it out, and wow, the results are wonderful. But, you know, is it the heavy metal or is it the electricity? Because, you know, we use tens. You've come across tens, haven't you, for the electrical current they put on your skin to reduce pain. Pregnancy, you know, like to put across the back as a form of natural pain relief. And that's just an electrical current at the right frequency. It's often used in electroacupuncture, for instance. You can put electricity between the different acupuncture needles. So you can get different results from that. And so those results can be beneficial or they can be detrimental. You know, without that electricity going across there, you wouldn't, or frequencies, you wouldn't have radio. So, and in the mouth, you know, we don't know if that electrical frequency that's set up in there is maybe stimulating the brain. So you take out the mercury fillings or the metal fillings like that, and whoops, the person feels a bit dull, you know, and then they wonder why.
Well, so these differences are really pretty wide-ranging, aren't they?
Well, they are. But obviously, for most people, they probably wouldn't notice. The teeth can be a bit sensitive for a time after these mercury fillings are removed. And I've often wondered if the electrical current was acting like a TENS machine. So the teeth might have been sore had the fillings not, you know, the fillings been neutral. And when you put in white fillings, they are neutral. So suddenly the teeth feel more sensitive. Is that because you've worked on them, or is that because you've taken out the electrical current? So, you know, this, because it's such a gray area and people don't, it's not a big money area for research either. So I don't know that people ask the questions to even start the research.
But I mean, you knowing what you know, I mean, I've had a couple of really, honest, frankly, quite astonishing kinesiologists in my time who have done amazing things for me, sometimes whilst being hundreds of miles away. Could you find that you can use your personal knowledge and understanding of what's going on in there in theory to actually get to more exact answers as to how these things are affecting the individuals that come to you?
Yes, I mean, you can use kinesiology, muscle testing to do that. But, you know, The trouble with all these things, it's that like homeopathy, because we haven't got the tools to actually test it scientifically. And you see, at the back of me, I'm very much a scientist. So when I'm using kinesiology, when I'm using homeopathy, I'm aware that these things work, but because I don't really know, because no one knows exactly how they work, that how much can we influence the findings? So I always like to have several different ways of arriving at the answer, just to collaborate, so that I'm not using one tool that I'm actually sure when I'm using muscle testing or that it works. But I also know that if I've got a sore muscle in my back, it's amazing how many people I find that I'm testing have sore muscles in their back. So I suddenly stop and think, whoa, am I not, you know, precariously putting the sore muscle into them as well? So it's kind of a, because we don't know how, I mean, our brains are just as powerful as theirs, but we could unwittingly be influencing the results of kinesiology, muscle testing, etc.
Yeah, yes, I know what you mean. I use it. I'm amazed at how consistent the results are, but I do think myself sometimes it would be really good to try some of these as kind of blind tests and see what actually occurs. I'm very interested to find that it is being used in the dentist surgery, though. What sort of homeopathy are you using? It's being used to support the other work you're doing, is it?
Well, no, I mean, I basically explored all the different tools of healthcare, including the traditional, from acupuncture right through to, you know, homeopathy and essential oils. I at one stage I explored crystals, and then there's the various body arts, you know, different types of therapies, and from yoga to Pilates, and then there's chiropractic, osteopathic, cranial osteopathy, and so on and so on and so on. So, but obviously, I started using hypnosis long before I became a dentist. These tools are out there, but you can't use them all yourself. So I have homeopaths and I have chiropractors and all these things around me, because ultimately I have to concentrate on dentistry. That's my line, you know. But it was good to delve into all these things, because you can use certain homeopathic remedies in day-to-day dentistry, and I was trained in homeopathic dentistry to be a homeopathic dentist by the Royal College of Homeopathy, and there's a whole section for dentists there. But the point is that the powers that be, like the General Dental Council, is not very kind of they're a bit oversensitive, I should say. You know, they're not forgiving about it too much, because they don't know about it, and when they don't know about it, they just shut it off and it doesn't exist. It doesn't work. It's useless. So people are very derisory like that, and especially unfortunately, medicine. You know, it's a little bit like one religion denounces another. And I've heard that quite often, you know, God is only really God in our religion, it's not in yours, you know?
Yeah.
So people are very protective about their belief structures. And unfortunately, we think science is pure, but there's a lot of dogma in that too, and also weird belief structures. People seem to be intellectually scientists, but they definitely have their limits as far as their questioning of the whole thing goes. And they can I'm not sure that this is also a fault of our social structure or our science structure, where people are very specialist. So, you know, the broad thinking is not encouraged too much.
No, so people only understand thoroughly about one very small area and don't know anything about the things that immediately surround it and support it.
Sure, because it has all kinds of reasons for this. One is that you can't know everything, but at the same time, it means that if somebody tries to question you on the peripheral stuff and you don't know, you feel challenged. So, better not go there. You know, it's not my line. So you stick to it, and so you can know a lot about very little, and but you don't know how it connects to the next thing, and that's the sad bit. And then of course you get protectionism coming in. So, in other words, when I was studying at university, it was the first. We were the first intake for that new faculty of dentistry at Stellenbosch University. So we had plenty of lecturers milling about, desperately trying to use their skills of teaching. So as a first intake, we had access to all the disciplines in dentistry, from surgery to orthodontics, to periodontics, to crown and bridge, endodontics, root canal treatments, you name it, we were there. And I came out really fairly competent in all these sort of disciplines. But nearing the end, they were started training specialists, and they got quite upset about the undergraduates doing such advanced work, because they needed them to refer patients from general practice to the specialists. Otherwise, they, you know, because they relied on referrals. If you're an orthodontist and you only do orthodontics, you need general practitioners to be pretty dumb about moving teeth around, because you want them to refer the patients to you. So, you know, if somebody knows all about orthodontics, they're actually kind of really almost a negative feature in your life.
And that means that you can, I guess, get sent maybe a little bit down the wrong path, because whoever sees you first is going to come to a conclusion about what it is you need, and then send you a person who's pretty determined to demonstrate that the right choice has been made.
Yeah, all those kind of things. So, yes, I mean, it's like, you know, orthodontists were, I hope they're changing now, but they were obsessed about taking out premolar teeth so there could be more space for the teeth to be spread out. And, of course, this is totally unnecessary. It deforms faces. They pull the teeth back into the area like that. So you straighten all the front teeth, but they move back into the space you've created towards the back. And, of course, it doesn't – so the front lips don't have the support of the teeth, so they fall back. So you can look at people that have had those teeth removed can often look a little bit dip-faced. So the nose and the chin seem to be enlarged, or the chin is a bit far back, so then they look a little bit like a pointy fish. You know, the nose is out there in the front, and so like an E-type face, you know.
So the teeth are kind of important. They're kind of like they're like structurally important to the whole build of your head.
Absolutely. So, you know, a face is designed to a pretty face is one where all the structures are built to the format that the original design is. You know, so if you mangle up the teeth so that the face isn't supported in the right way, it not only doesn't function properly and doesn't support the face properly, but it also has repercussions for the neck. And if the neck is disturbed and the cranium, then of course the repercussions are there for the lower back. And if all the spine is all to cock because the teeth are to cock, then nerves are squeezed and not functioning properly. So you could have impairment of function in the lungs, the heart, down in the stomach, because the phrenic nerve goes all the way down there, and various other nerves obviously are caught up lower down, so you can have bowel, sections of the bowel that aren't working quite so well. You can have prostate problems or uterus problems, all to do with chiropractic irregularities, and those could be obviously set up from problems in the hips, and those that could travel up and cause problems in the teeth or the face. But often the place that is most variable because of function and diet and God knows what else and intervention are the teeth. So you know, headaches, facial pain, and then repercussions for, let's say, cranial balance and spinal balance often originate from the mouth.
Yeah, it's funny you should mention painful face and stuff, because Dot, and we've got a chat box here at People's Internet Radio that I'm keeping an eye on, and he's put, I've got a pain in my ear stroke jaw 24 hours a day or every day of the year, and he says talking to a doctor's like talking to the wall. Perhaps he needs to talk to somebody more like yourself.
Yeah, what he should do is talk to the wall more. Because it's less frustrating, so he wouldn't get as tense, you know. But no, it's true, because I've just had a patient in the last 2 weeks who's come to me, which is classic. Been to her dentist, regularly, complaining about pain in the lower jaw, but sometimes it goes into the upper jaw and sometimes towards the ear. But it definitely feels like the lower teeth are the ones that are sore. That's her kind of feedback. And, of course, she's been several times to a dentist who's x-rayed them and told her that everything's fine. So, obviously, she comes to me, and I listen to her, which, of course, is the best thing, because the patient actually tells you exactly what's wrong if you just listen. And sometimes you just have to kind of ask a few questions and find out more about what they're going to tell you. But ultimately, it comes out, and so you say, okay, so let's check the bite, and you find that they're heavy on that side, and they've got muscles that are sore on that side, and of course, if the muscles are under pressure, because let me go back a step to explain the background of why this all happens, is that the teeth are irreplaceable, we know that, because they're only a one-off build, they built. If they're damaged, they're never rebuilt. So we have a big section of our brain that's dedicated to the proprioception of the teeth. In the periodontal ligament, there are lots of nerves, very exquisitely sensitive. So you can feel minute changes to the pressure on teeth. And so when we're eating, we actually never touch our teeth together. They bite up to a thou from each other and stop. And so they're masticating, because our teeth are, it's like two diamonds hitting each other, one can break. So we really don't want our teeth to actually physically touch when we really chew them away. But to do that, you need an exquisite relationship, like a dance between the nerves telling the muscles what is going on, so they behave exactly in this thing, and then the nerves will tell them how close they are, oops, and they stop when the teeth are close. And so this is going on all the time, obviously subconsciously. And so when the teeth are upset, like you bang them, then the muscles get tense because they're trying to protect these teeth from hurting themselves. So then that sets up facial pain, because it's stress in the muscles. And that facial pain, those muscles can have something to do with the ear, they can have something to do with the neck, they can go right up at the scalp, they can affect the way blood vessels work, so you can get vasodilation or vasoconstriction in the brain, so you can get headaches. And so it goes. So when you find out that the teeth aren't working together properly, there's imbalance, you can do a few things. You can either adjust the teeth, or you can make a little plastic plate that's molded to fit in as if the teeth were a little bit higher up. But you can adjust that plate so that the teeth fit more happily together. So it's like an artificial bite, but it's that the plate, this little plastic plate, acts as like a shock absorber, so that you're not upsetting the teeth. The muscles can all relax. Then you can test how the jaw comes together to find out if the tense muscles are making the teeth come together more, or is it that the teeth have moved so they're touching each other too much, so you need to adjust them. But what you really want to do is to send the patient off to a chiropractor to work on the spine and the neck and the cranium, so that all these muscles can relax a little bit, so that you get a genuine feedback about what the teeth are doing to each other. So then you can say, well, they are so badly out of sync with the top teeth or the bottom teeth that you really need to move the teeth around or rebuild them so that they are touching correctly. So as an interim period, you can use this plastic plate, and then you can slowly rebuild the teeth, or you just have to move them orthodontically until they're in the right place. Or it's not a big deal, so you can just take off a little bit of enamel, like polish the surfaces so the bite fits together beautifully and functions properly. Then suddenly the muscles say, the teeth are fitting together better, and they're not upsetting us. So they relax, and then all the functions in the ear and the jaw and that all come together very nicely.
That's absolutely amazing.
Yeah. No, it is. It is an amazing place, you know, the mouth. Very interesting, and its repercussions to the rest of the body are so fascinating, and that's why it's actually so exciting to be a dentist. A dentist that's informed, that is, you know. But, you know, it's very bad to be informed in this very derogatory sort of world, because people sometimes don't like you very much, especially those in the regulatory and power places, because you're just making waves, you know.
Yes, indeed, yes. And I'm not sure they're always interested in, as interested in making people better as they are in making money.
And power and position and all that stuff. It's very complex, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, they're certainly enjoying you in the chat box. We're getting comments like, this guy is amazing and amazing info. And I mean, we'll go to a music break in a minute or so, give you a bit of a break. But are there many of you about? I mean, I've been having trouble with my teeth for as long as I can remember, and I've never come across an holistic dentist, even though I've been extensively using complementary practitioners pretty much exclusively for 20 years now. You must be pretty rare, aren't you?
Well, I must admit there are a few of us around, but you see, it is difficult, because I'm not sure. There are those that are taken interest, say, in chiropractic or cranial osteopathy, maybe a bit in this and a bit of that, but not necessarily the whole package. And also, it's all to do with the philosophy. But I know that there are some wonderful colleagues out there, some that have been my teachers, and so they're very inspirational people. That have been pathfinders, some that have actually made international roads through the jungle, in fact, and maybe not and maybe never received the accolades they should have. But, the knowledge is there, and so it's just that our environment, needs more people, possibly like those that are listening to your show, to go out and change the world, because it is the patient that has to change the world, not the practitioners. I know we do a lot, and I have done a lot to try and inform people, and the internet has helped, but the pressure of the people on the regulators on demanding more is what will eventually make the difference. Because certainly the regulators think that the dentist wants to do all this, but is it necessary? You know, it's not right. Surely if a patient needs nutrition for a healthy gut so that they don't have gum disease, they should go to the doctor for the nutrition. You know, why should the dentist do it? You know, but because they try to disassemble body parts. They don't, you know, the mouth hasn't got anything to do with the gut. You know, it's weird and quite ignorant, terrifying in fact.
And surely the question isn't necessarily, is it necessary, but, you know, has it worked? Does it work? And if it does work, wouldn't it be great if the science started looking towards things that were helpful and started to trying to validate some of this stuff? Because I'm pretty sure, apart from the Institute of Noetic Sciences, there don't seem to be too many people doing work into such things.
Well, you'd be surprised. They actually are, because obviously I tap all this knowledge for myself. You know, it's out there, and there are. Most amazing people that have dedicated their lives to assemble this knowledge and to spread it. Not necessarily dentists, you know. These are nutritionists, enterologists, you name it. You know, even neurologists and so on. That I've listened to that are sort of holistic in their own field, and they've taken on board a wider concept of health. And they're doing a lot of research, and of course I listen to their talks, I read their stuff, and if you think about it clearly, obviously, what is good for one body part is good for another. You know, the gums have got just as much the same blood vessels and structure as the heart. And when in 1998, I listened to a professor giving a BBC interview about the relationship between heart disease and gum disease that they found exists. And when he was asked by the BBC interviewer what they were thinking was the cause, and he said, well, they're looking for the bug that's in the mouth that might have an effect on the heart. And then they turned to me because I was happened to be asked to give an input on this interview. And when I said, well, I think you'll find it a little bit more complex than that, and that which supports the heart supports the lung, the gums. And to be fair, this prof actually said that there are quite a few people that think like Dr. Ferraris, and there might be something in it, and their faculty went on to change the whole definition of gum disease. So it was half a decade later, but it happened. So, you know, things do change, and science does catch up, but that faculty is still a bit lonely. I was looking up the other day to see how many people have changed the definition of gum disease, and by God, it's still centered around bugs. You know? So there's a lot of resistance to change.
Yeah. Though things are changing, which is really great. I'll tell you what, let's play 10 minutes of music, and then when we come back, it'd be really good to have a chat about the gums and what we can do to kind of keep them healthy. If that's good with you.
That's fine. That's lovely. I'd like to share that because I think there are a lot of people out there that need that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's brilliant. You've been listening to, Stuart Ferraris there, holistic dentist. Clearly it's as much news to all of you as it is to me that such people are out there. And I'm going to put on 10 minutes of music or so that we go and get a chance to go and get ourselves a glass of water or a cup of tea or whatever, and we will be back with you then. So here's Souljacker Part 1 from the Eels, back with you in 10 minutes or so. There you go, Led Zeppelin there, and how many more times from their legendary first album. And we're back on People's Internet Radio with Stuart Ferraris, and we're talking Matters Dental. And we left off and we were going to talk a bit about how we might consider helping to keep our gums healthy, Stuart, because that seems to be a problem that many people have got in this modern age. Oh, hang on a moment, I'm missing you there. There we go. I don't know whether, did you hear that question?
Oh, absolutely, and no, I'm with you. Sorry, I'm
very good. No, it's okay. I forgot to press one of the buttons on my desk here. Like I say, I've only been doing it 4 years and I still forget to do that. But we've got you back with us now. So what can we do to help keep our gums in some sort of, in better condition?
Well, of course, the commonly well-known, aspect is getting a brush in your mouth. And by far in our modern day, that's the best way of dealing with gums from a hygiene point of view and a proactive point of view. Obviously, we have been obsessed with brushing our teeth, and what I try to tell people is, it's the gums that are important. If you look after the gums, the teeth will be looked after as well, because it's difficult not to. But I did make a little video of how to use the brush for gums, and I put it on YouTube, but I have to redo it because it's somehow been lost. But I'll get back to that again, because I made this little video with somebody filming, and of course I get very self-conscious in front of a camera, stupidly, because that I can stand in front of a whole audience. But when it's being filmed, somehow it's different. You know, so I really have respect for actors who can do this without getting all wobbly. You know? Anyway, what it is that, I like to explain to people: if you massage the gums with your toothbrush, what you're doing is you're increasing the circulation, and circulation is bringing nutrition, it's taking toxins away, it's bringing the immune cells in to defend the gums against the bugs that are in the mouth. So it's very important to get that circulation. And by taking the brush and almost like dry skin brushing. You can put toothpaste on it, obviously, and do that. But if you doing a little round jig with your toothbrush, so the bristles are just working in a almost like a massaging type way on the gums, especially where the gums meet the teeth, then you're not only cleaning away the plaque, but you're also getting the circulation. You work your way methodically around the mouth. And where you find the gums are sore, that's where you've really got to concentrate on massaging more, because the pain is the pain of inflammation. There are several aspects of inflammation. When you get inflammation, you get redness, you get swelling, and you get pain. And so what you want to do is to massage that to get the circulation in there that takes away the edema of inflammation, you get healing, and the pain goes. Then you know that you've achieved the result. And it usually takes about 48 hours, and that pain won't be there. But then you carry on around your mouth, and you can use that pain as an indicator that that's where you've got to spend more time with your massaging than at other places.
Do you know, that's one of the most useful pieces of information I think I've heard. I wish I'd heard it years ago, because, of course, instinctively, there's probably a tendency to try and avoid brushing the places that hurt when you brush them.
Well, absolutely. And I have frightening problems. You know, I've got people that have had implants and they're scared to brush there. And I repeatedly tell them, please massage, massage. And they go away and they say yes. And they come back and they say, it's still bleeding. And I always tear my hair out, because they are so instinctively, they cannot even hear what I'm saying. So the whole thing breaks down, and they lose it like they lost their tooth, you know, and they say, oh, but it's not my fault. Well, whose fault is it? It can only be, you know, it's not. And then I feel like blame society, because we you know, as you say, you didn't get the message. So the message isn't out there. And people are so closeted about pain, and they don't understand why the pain is there. So you try and explain it, but they can't hear you, because there's so much traditional concept. And people are very peculiar because, as I said, most people get the message and they do it. And I've got such a successful practice of very healthy patients. It's so delicious. It's exactly what I was trained to do. I've achieved it, and I'm so happy. You know, and of course, the patients are happy too. Those that listen and do their homework. So that's the one fundamental thing is doing that, because if you go along back to Paleolithic times, which wasn't that long ago, remember we only have domesticated crops and animals for the last between 10 and 30 years, depending on where on the planet we are. You know? So that's not a long time, 30,000 years, right? If we've been around a million or so, that's, the 30,000 is nothing. And so all our genetics, our development, our function has always been geared and formed in the Paleolithic periods where we were hunter-gatherers. Now, food, a banana wasn't a big thing with soft in the middle. It was probably much smaller. we've developed these things traditionally to be bigger. And certainly potatoes tended to be probably a little bit smaller. Apples were definitely very small. General fruits were small and hard and damn difficult to chew. And certainly the roots and berries and things and even the early wheats that they discovered and chewed on cereals, wild cereals, were very small grained and hard, and it took a long time to get a lot of them to chew and eat to get your nourishment. So these guys chewed a lot, they wore down their teeth a lot, but the fiber of what they were eating was massaging the gums. Our soft food today does not do that, so we're not getting that massaging of the gums, so we need to do it artificially with our toothbrush. And also, of course, to get away the nonsense and deposits of soft food. And I have to tell people that have got dentures to do that as well, even if they've got no teeth, because the dentures sitting on the gums, and of course they're getting even less stimulation from food than with teeth, because the plastic is covering the soft tissues, the gums. So take them out, massage the gums so the tissues stay healthy. You don't get fungus and various things like that growing on the gums under the denture. You know, you don't want all that stuff growing there, yeast and things. So it's good to massage the gums, clean the plates, and then it goes back again. You know, give your mouth a chance to breathe. So you know, so once you've got no teeth, you've still got problems. So you need to know that stuff as well. And then, of course, the other aspect is that Paleolithic man did not have dentists to fix teeth and to clean them. So how did they manage? They didn't need to do it. It's a modern manifestation. So bugs have always been around. They were around then. It was the immune system. These people were healthy, otherwise they died. There was no forgiving. There was no medicine. There was no pick-me-ups, drugs in between. It was truly the survival of the fittest. So if you weren't fit, you were recycled, and you became something else, a dog, a cat, a tree. You know, but certainly you were useless as a human being, and as it is for the whole animal kingdom. So therefore, nature was pretty brutal like that, but it was good at recycling. Everything had a use and was turned back into something useful. You know, you didn't have zombies lying in beds for too long, people that weren't functioning properly. It's a privilege. That's a privilege of our modern society, if you call it that. Anyway, so it's important to be healthy. You mentioned drinking water. It's you need to drink water, and not just teas, coffees, beverages, etc. There's got to be water coming in, because you need to flush the system. And if the system is well flashed, then, you know, there's nothing wrong with tea. It's pretty good stuff. It's got phytochemicals in it that are pretty healthy to you. I think a lot of Brits, especially the Scots for that matter, survive on the antioxidants in tea, because they certainly don't seem to eat a lot of other things with antioxidants in them. So the old English or British tea is a marvelous tradition. So if you have lots of fluids, your kidneys are flushed, your liver is flushed, your skin has a chance to perspire, so you can get rid of toxins that way. It's very important to have the mobilization of moisture, and so if the body is healthy, then the heart is healthy, the gums are healthy. It's not a segregated business. You know, obviously there are genetic predispositions, so one person, the gums might be less resistant to hardship than the heart, and somebody can lose their teeth but their heart goes on for ages, you know, without any hassles. So there's not a strict thing.
It doesn't necessarily mean if you've got bad gums that there's probably things wrong with your heart as well.
No, not necessary, but it's a pretty, you know, it often means that you're prone to inflammatory disease. And I know I had myself genetically tested, so I've got a much more of a genetic predisposition to inflammation. So I need to do things and eat things that reduce my inflammatory profile, so that because I've got all these mangled joints and things, I was promised 30 years ago that I would be crippled with arthritis. And there are a lot of those doctors that told me that have got arthritis now, and I haven't. So it's just that you need to know why you get arthritis. So you've got to keep your inflammatory profile down, and lots of antioxidants in your diet. Movement is good. So you've got to do exercise. I find I can't walk because my ankles obviously are just the bags of bones. Yes, I can walk, fortunately, which they told me I wouldn't be able to, but it's still sore because they aren't proper joints. But I can get around. I've been up mountains. But cycling is easier because it's not weight bearing on my ankle. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And swimming is great too. You know, so you find an activity that you still can do depending on what your restrictions are.
What sort of modifications do you make to counteract your tendency towards inflammation?
Well, as I said, you've got to make sure that you have to reduce things that inflame you. Like, you know, I'm aware that obviously if my ankles get inflamed, that's sending a message to the rest of the body that, you know, things are hurting. So mediators go out and they say, alarm, alarm, alarm. You know, this tissues are hurting. So that sends the whole body into an inflammatory process. So therefore, I must make sure that I don't let that inflammation fester. I've got to massage my ankles. I've got to give them hot cold treatment. I've got to rub oils into them. I've got to stretch. I've got to do yoga. I do stretching before I go to bed. I massage things and so on. So you have to introduce a lot of things to stop parts of your body being inflamed, because that sets off inflammation. But you've also got to, like I say, have lots of fluid, so you flush your body, so you haven't got toxins in your body. And you've got to have lots of antioxidants, you know, foods rich in phytochemicals, which are the greens, the reds, the colored bits of fruit and vegetables. That's where a lot of our antioxidants are. And good oils, oils from fish, oils from plants. These are very good for us, for lubrication, even for the brain and for cell function and all the rest of it. but they mustn't be saturated fats. You can have a few of those, but obviously they're not particularly lubricating. They tend to make our bodies stiff.
I've heard that coconut oil is really good for that, for people who don't eat fish. Is that correct?
Yes. I mean, coconut oil is fantastic. It's very stable. You can use it even for cooking and things without degrading too much, as is olive oil that way, but you mustn't reuse it because it does get damaged with heat. And obviously, like all these things, coconut oil is a very good oil. It's plant oil. But one should have variety of oils, oils from different nuts, oils from different seeds, oil from fish if you can. And so it goes. So, because variety is the spice for us. There's no one thing that cures, and food substances from different parts of the world have different minerals and different components to them. And I could go into the whole side of organic and so on, and as we've done before, but we won't do that. But just be aware, speak to a good nutritionist about that, or somebody that knows about the sort of supplements that you could take to augment what you might not be getting in your diet. So diet is very, very important to this sort of immune system that we have, and the immune system is the thing that defends us and repairs them. And if you keep your mouth clean, that's another source of reducing inflammation, because obviously if the gums don't get inflamed, they're not sending any mediators out. And if you have a liver that's congested, of course, then it's not getting rid of the bile and the toxins, so you're getting stasis and dis-ease in the body. And a lot of problems come from the gut, because if people traditionally get indigestion, and indigestion means that you're not digesting, so they seem to have forgotten what the term means, because it just means that they're getting flatulence, or they're getting acidic tummy. So what you've got to do is take antacids, because the tummy's making too much acid. The tummy isn't making too much acid at all. It's because they've indulged and the food is rotting in the stomach, and as it's putrefying, it's making acid, which the stomach hates, because it's not the stomach for digestion, not the acid for digestion. So what happens is they not only have the wrong acid in the stomach and it's putrefying food that's in a lovely warm environment, but there's no acid to digest it, no stomach acid. So it sits there until you either passes into the duodenum, or you take antacids, and then it's undigested, and it moves into the duodenum. But the duodenum needs hydrochloric acid, the stomach acid, to stimulate the pancreas and the liver. And if you don't have that, your liver doesn't send bile out to neutralize it, and the pancreas doesn't work. So you're then disturbing the whole digestion at the top of the spectrum, which leads to damage to the gut downstream, which means that you're setting up a huge inflammatory problem for yourself in the gut.
So by taking antacids, you're effectively addressing a symptom and leaving yourself with a bigger problem.
Absolutely. And it's done. There's a huge business in antacids out in the world there. And so they're creating such a wide spectrum of chronic disease. It's unbelievable. And the same with antibiotics, because they destroy the gut bacteria, and the gut bacteria are there to keep equilibrium in the gut, help us digest stuff, but also keep the bad boys out. So then you get a gut which isn't working properly. It's letting the wrong things through and not letting the right things through. So you've got half your immune system is around your gut. So that's upregulated and inflamed. So that sort of sends the whole body into a tizz. you also get allergies because wrong things come in, the immune system starts grappling to try and kill things. It sets up an allergic reaction, an incorrect immune response, basically. And then, of course, there's all that they say that the gut is the second brain because there's so much neurology around the gut because the brain needs to know what's going on down there. So there's a huge network of nerves down there. And so that disturbs the neurology around the gut. There's actually serotonin produced by the gut, which is the hormone that's produced by our brain that relaxes us.
I didn't know you got serotonin in the gut. That's a new piece of information to me.
Yeah, and that's exactly the problem, that when all this goes haywire, the brain gets upset by what's going on in the gut, and so you get all kinds of neurological disturbances, and so the whole business gets unraveled. So not only do you have gum disease, but there's a lot of other disease out there that stems from the gut. So things start going wrong in the mouth, and we don't address. I say to people, if you get indigestion, if you can't chew your food properly, either you've got to eat very small amounts so that you can at least let the stomach work on it. And of course, a stressed person suppresses acid in the stomach. So they're not digesting, because obviously if you're being chased by a tiger, the last thing your body wants to worry about is digesting your lunch, because don't escape, you're not going to be around to digest your lunch. So basically it shuts down a lot of different functions of your body so that you can, and upregulates your leg muscles to run like buggery, you know, so that you can get away. But most of us are chased by tigers almost right throughout the day. Because it's the driver behind us, it's the boss at work, it's the clients, it's this, it's that, it's the missus, the mother, the father, whatever. So we are stressed to hell, so our systems aren't working properly. So, we spoke about, doing relaxing things, go for a walk, meditation, think nice thoughts.
Spend your time with people you like being with.
Absolutely, and that's why, ultimately, it's better to drink in a pub with people and chat to them and upload than it is to sit at home and drink.
I guess that this is a kind of balance, isn't it, between things that physically generate themselves as a result of our immune system and our digestive system and things that we're experiencing in our mind.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, the thing is, and again, the holistic view is you don't segregate the two, because one feeds the other, and you can do soothing physical things, which soothes the brain. You can have soothing thoughts, which soothes the physical. So if there's no such thing as a fence, it's not one or the other. The body works in a very compensating feedback sort of way. It's used to cooperating. It's the best cooperating system. It's a phenomenally exciting system.
Yeah, and I guess the more you know about it, the better, really. There again is a tendency in general practice to actually not be given a lot of information. People seem to go in there, have their 7 or 8 minutes, take the pill, and that's it, and don't learn anything about what's actually going on. I've learned a huge amount from interacting with the various therapists I've met over the last couple of decades, and that is part of the process of healing yourself, isn't it?
Well, of course it is, because it's self-empowerment, or empowering the patient through knowledge. It's no use you doing the work, because you can't heal anybody. There's only you and God that can do the healing, and maybe God's got other stuff to do. So
yes, I have read that, and I believe it to be true myself, that it doesn't matter how special the specialist is or how powerful the drug is or whatever. Ultimately, it's always the individual that heals themselves. That's ultimately what's going on, isn't it?
Sure, because what the healer or the physician does is facilitates. So in other words, whether you're using a drug or you're using physical therapy, you're trying to remove obstacles to healing, or you're trying to give input so that you can enhance healing. All these aspects are about getting the body's own potential to sort itself out, because, as I say, the complexity of the body is so exquisite that we have got no chance in going and sorting it all out. If you're born and you're alive, you have the tools generally, and I'll say this generally, to sort it out. And everybody believes they are so unique that their problem is so unique and they can't sort it out. It's bullshit. Oh, I think, sorry. It's nonsense. You know? you've got to take the responsibility on. It's your problem, it's your body, it's your health. You've got to accept that responsibility, and then the other person can do things to help you. I've spoken with cancer patients. I've said, you've got to accept that you've caused the cancer. And people said, how can you say that? You're saying that they caused the cancer? Yes, because nobody else did. And if they don't believe they caused the cancer, they cannot help themselves. Because if somebody else caused the cancer, they have to go through that somebody else to undo the cancer.
My understanding of that is that really it's about the last ditch attempt of your immune system to sort out a problem that you've been ignoring. Presumably it's presented itself as a series of symptoms beforehand, and this is just the kind of last ditch. Is that how you see it?
Well, it is a very compromised immune system, but you know, immune systems vary in their compromise from, you know, getting flu to any other sort of bug coming in, and then the immune system being out of sync on the fundamental basis of cellular irregularities being ignored is probably where the immune system is really kind of knackered, you know. So, but you know, cancer usually starts at least a decade or more before it presents. It's something that forms a long time because you get a genetic mutilation that is perpetuated in the next cell eventually that's made. For those cells to replicate until they become a significant size, it takes quite a long time. And I believe, and I'm sure that there are a lot of people out there that realize that a lot of cancers form in us virtually daily, and we extinguish them. So our body is well set up to get rid of cancer. It's just, that's why you get these miracles where people get rid of full-blown cancer when they put their mind to it, and they restore their body to a milieu that works well. You know, if you're living badly, you're stressed and all the rest of it, you just get out of that. The typical story that was told in South Africa was where this a chap was riddled with cancer. He was given the thumbs down, and he always dreamt of just mooching his way around Greece on a donkey. That was his kind of dream, you know. And what he did was he took all the money he had and left it with his missus for the kids and herself, and said, "Look, you know, I'm pretty doomed. They've given me several months. If I stick around, I'm just going to be a financial drain on the family, and I'm going to take myself off I've got enough money to buy a donkey and feed myself a little bit and all this stuff. Sort of, but I'm not going to be around for long, so I'm just going to do what I want to do. And at least you see me disappear as husband and father. You know, not an easy thing to do, but he did that. And several years later, he was still mooching around on a donkey in a much healthier state, very healthy and happy and suntanned. So, you know, the cancer disappeared. Isn't that strange? So there you are. So that's what happens if you get the right balance back again.
And, yeah, it reminds me of Joe Campbell's advice, saying that that always we should follow our heart, that it's the best thing we can do. And that man, when he followed his heart and got on his donkey, he was happy and his system could redress itself.
Sure. And, you know, as I say, he took himself into a milieu where they, you know, the sunshine, and of course there was sunshine in South Africa, but he was putting himself in the sunshine because he probably had an office job and going crazy and never seeing the sunshine, breathing foul air, drinking foul stuff, eating foul stuff, and listening to foul stress wherever he went. So he just took himself out of that. His body then suddenly reset itself. It's like a computer that goes weird. You sort of switch it off, beautiful humans, and switch it on again, and then somehow it rejigs itself. So, you know, but I mean, to get back to gums, you know, they're all part of the whole health of the system. So whatever you need to do for your body's health, you need to do for your gums. And then, of course, that's on the wider issue. And then, of course, you do what I told you about massaging the gums. And that's a good place to start. More complex than that, I don't think we should get at this stage.
Yeah. On the subject of antibiotics, you mentioned them a couple of times, and I'm aware that there are times in dentistry when really it is advisable to use them. Do you offer any sort of support? I mean, presumably you do use them, do you? Do you use antibiotics?
Well, yes. No, antibiotics are very useful. And I say, if I have to use them, when you're doing things like implants and you're putting stuff into a bone which you want to grow into the bone, or grow the bone to grow around a titanium root, if there's any infection there, it can set things back and the integration won't be very successful. So you give antibiotics where really most of the time you wouldn't have to, but, you know, I think because we're kind of a little bit unsure, so you don't want to take the risk because it's a hell of an expensive thing to fail. So you give antibiotics, but then I always suggest to the patients to follow up with probiotics and prebiotics afterwards, so that the damage done by the antibiotics is annulled with a good course and high doses of pro and prebiotics.
And what sort of form do they take?
Well, you basically, they come in powder and capsules at the health store. You know, obviously, you can, there's dietary things like yogurts and things like that, but they're more supportive. There's usually, even natural yogurts haven't got enough probiotics in to make a huge difference to a gut that's just been damaged by antibiotics. Mm-hmm. The best is to really give high titers and doses of the broad spectrum probiotics that you would get.
Have you heard of these strange mushrooms that people grow? Things like kombucha, I heard, are recommended by some people as being intensely probiotic.
No, they're intensely prebiotic. They are the fiber that breaks down in the gut that the bacteria eat. So they are what we call prebiotics. That's the food for the bacteria. And when they break down the fiber in our diet, the byproducts can be very useful to us. Sometimes they can be useful for us to absorb, or they can be the small molecules that send messages to our immune system that regulates the immune system. There's a whole lot of research on the biodiversity and input of the function of the gut flora and fauna. You know, for that, it's like a there's supposed to be more cells in terms of the bugs in our gut than our own body. It's just an amazing. They're very useful to us. They've been living with us for years, and most animals have them. Some animals like the cows have a crop, as it were, a number one stomach, where a lot of the digestion is done by probiotics. Probiotics, the bacteria, and they live on the fiber from the grass and stuff. And break it down and help the cow. Then it goes into the proper stomach, and then they can take it from there. So this is conventionalism or symbiotic behavior of these bugs. We give them a home, and they give us something back for the effort of carrying it down. So, but you know, if we disturb that by not having the right diets, by using antibiotics, by being stressed so that we don't have proper acid forming in our stomach, so we don't then have proper digestion, so the food isn't prepared for digestion in the gut, so there's a lot of putrefaction and rotting. This tends to be a good milieu for the wrong bugs to grow, and then they overpower the good ones, and so you start getting an environment like the Morris, where there are lots of seagulls and not enough of the diversity of birds, you know? And so they become pests rather than something elegant and graceful, you know?
When we were talking earlier about teeth and their relationship to so much of the rest of the body, you know, to the spine and the face and the way the stomach and everything's working, does that mean that we are necessarily in trouble if we find ourselves with a full set of dentures for whatever reason? Is there work we need to do if we get dentures that we might not otherwise have to do?
Yes, I've had patients coming in with problems of the jaw and the neck and the back with dentures, because the dentures haven't been constructed to support the jaws properly. So there's a, if you think of a face, there's an optimum height from the tip of the chin to the bottom of the nose, and that's pretty constant throughout life. I remember I mentioned earlier about in Paleolithic man, the teeth wore down with the rough food. And I was just chatting to a patient about that today, I think, about the fact that as the teeth wear away on the biting surface, the bone that supports the teeth, called the alveolar bone and the gums, they grow up or down, depending on which jaw it is. So the teeth, the what they call the occlusal plane, where the teeth meet, stays on the lip line, and it so that your almost your ridges grow up and push the teeth up so that they're still meeting at that line, and so the facial height stays constant. So what happens is when people get dentures, it's easier to make the dentures with the teeth much smaller and lower, because they stay in place easier, because the lips and the tongue fold over them, so they help them to stay in place. But you see when people have dentures, often they bite and their chin comes closer to their nose. So, and the teeth, and their mouth goes almost like they haven't got teeth. You know, the little scratches out like that. And so, and that can cause discomfort in the muscles. And then, of course, again, it can cause tinnitus and ear problems because the muscles in the ears are fed by the same nerve branch as the muscles of mastication. So the ramifications of problems throughout the, what they call the trigeminal nerve can have far-reaching effects to disturbing symptoms in the face, going through the ears, through the, and vascularity problems. So you have headaches or facial pain of different types and kinds, and then you have muscle pain in the neck and in the back. So on. So what you do is you remake the dentures to build them up to a height that allows the jaw to be at its optimum height. That restores that distance between the base of the nose and the tip of the chin. And then they usually feel much better. Of course, again, they need to see a physical therapist, like a physiotherapist, chiropractor, osteopath, etc., so that all the damage that's been done to the spine can be corrected, because that has become a manifestation of its own now and needs to be sorted out, even if the teeth are sorted out, because obviously the longer that's there, you have fibrous changes, you have subluxations which get locked into place. So that needs a lot of work to undo that. And obviously good symmetrical exercise is often very important to complement that work.
So I guess it's important then, if you're going to get a set of dentures, to make sure that you get a good set. Do you think you're likely to get that on the NHS?
It depends how committed the practitioner is. You know, if they, I left the NHS because it became a charity shop. You know, because ultimately, if you're philanthropical, you can do really good work. But you know, unfortunately, you don't get an income because all the money goes on to providing service. So you know, if you're going to do a proper job, it's very difficult in the budget dictated by the NHS. So I think that an NHS dentist has to throw together real quick. If you're lucky, I've seen people very happy with the NHS dentures, whether they are very tolerant or whether they were very lucky or whether that practitioner is so used to making dentures that they have a good eye for it and they can do a real quick job, and most of the time it's successful. And then you're lucky. It's one of those hit and miss things. I wouldn't say that it's, I think that NHS dentists are under a lot of pressure, and I feel for them, and I have every respect for those that are trying to do it because they feel that it's the right thing to do. And if they can pull it off, great. It makes them happy and it makes their patients happy. That's a wonderful.
It's, of course, not quite so cheap as it used to be either. I mean, it's certainly part of the NHS that's no longer, just by a long chalk, it's not free at the point of service anymore.
Oh, definitely not. But you see, they are restricted by what they can do and the fees that are involved. So it's still not reimbursed correctly. Very difficult. My personal feeling is, and I've talked to patients who have said, whined about the lack of NHS, and I've just said that unfortunately we are a bit of a nanny state, based on expectations that aren't really appropriate for where we are in the world today. When the NHS was introduced, there was a lot of poverty in this country. There was just no access to medical or dental care for a lot of the population. So it was a wonderful service to introduce. The population in the UK today is so affluent compared to 60 years ago. So basically, I think that we need to say, okay, but there are people that need the NHS or that service to support them. And I'm not saying that I think that the medical side of the NHS is wonderful, but I often feel that I would like more the big things subsidized, like hips and heart and you know, God forbid, cancer treatments and all that sort of stuff. I hope that I will never need that, and I don't believe I will. So, but that's because I believe that if you really do do a healthy kind of lifestyle, you don't get disease. And I've sort of proved that in my life. And I've seen that with people that do the same. So, but we are led to believe that disease is something that's foisted upon us rather than it's created by ourselves. You know, obviously, it's not, I can't expect everybody to have had the privilege of knowledge about health and disease that I have had. So I feel that it is the fault of the system for not educating people. The knowledge is out there. People do say, walk more, do this more, do that more. But I always feel that when I go and I see a cardiac clinic up at the hospital, I feel that the consultant should gather all these patients that come in there and take them for a 10-mile walk and come back to the clinic and say, right, that was your first session. Now book in if you really still have a problem after you've walked like that for a daily for the next sort of week or two, you know? And probably they'll find that they don't need the cardiac surgery because the blood pressure will drop.
It would be great, wouldn't it, if the whole health service was to start tending towards the preventative rather than the dealing with it once the orgy is in the air conditioning, as it were.
Absolutely, no, that's exactly right. I think that, you know, I've often said that what they need to do is to make the appointments with patients at least a half an hour, an hour long, deal with the problem, explain where the problem is coming from, get the patient involved with the healing. And then you find that you will get a better remission of the problem maybe at a quick and early stage and a lot more cost effectively. Obviously, there will be quite a lot of manpower involved initially. But, you know, it's like you go to Greece where it's kind of a bit expensive to go to a hospital, generally. And so, and you go in, a pseudo uncle of mine was in hospital there, and, you know, most hospitals, the relatives have to bring food in for the patients. They haven't got the in-house feeding system. And so, it's a disincentive to be ill, right? So there's that to it too. You know, here, people can go and work for very little kind of problems. They go rushing into their GP and complain they want medication because they've got this problem. And there's all kinds of vested reasons why they complain, because especially in Wales where they can get free prescriptions, so they don't even want to buy paracetamol. You know, if that's what they want. I don't know why people would want to have paracetamol, but the point is that they can get it free rather than pay 50 cents for it. And, you know, it just appalls me that, you know, that the population has got to that stage where, because it's free, we want it. I was in South Africa where there was free medicine for everybody, whites and blacks. And obviously, if you had a higher income, you paid a higher kind of fee when you went in, but it still was low. It was pathetically low. And but you know, I just felt that service was there for those that really couldn't afford to pay, and I was paying income tax to support it. But suddenly, you know, that's what I was doing, and that was my kind of feedback into the community for the privileges that I've had out of getting an education and things. So,
and I guess that, you know, it is, again, it's a subject that we come to again and again on People's Internet Radio, is the business of taking responsibility for what's happening to you. And if we were concentrating on encouraging people to do that, then the system would be able to deal a lot more effectively and a lot more generously with the few people who really did need it.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's what I'm saying. That, you know, it can. You see, if you were in an accident and your legs chopped off, that can be quite an expensive process of getting to the hospital and then getting artificial legs and things, because you might be out of work for a while, so you're not earning money. And so it's a little bit like an insurance system, but I'm not sure that I like to go to private insurances for health, because those two, you know, like, they're big in the States, and they all have vested interests almost in people staying unhealthy, because otherwise they wouldn't belong to them, you know? And so you can charge a lot, because people are so scared of not having their health insurance to look after them when they're sick, you know? And so even in a highly affluent place like the States, people are absolutely almost more sick because they're obsessed with illness. I'm going to be ill, what happens? I'm going to pay, you know? It's terrifying, you know? It's like, why do you want to be ill? You know? Why would you invite that in?
I remember hearing insurance defined as betting against yourself.
That's right. You know, I mean, you know, have I got health insurance? No, I haven't. Do I go to the NHS facilities all the time? No, I don't. And you know, I was grateful for the NHS facilities when I had the accident. God, I mean, that was an expensive process that put me through. But afterwards, the support was abysmal. You know, if I hadn't gone in to find out how to make myself better and to keep myself better, I would be probably invalided and on benefit. You know, so it's just what you want out of life, and I certainly didn't want to be dependent on anybody. I couldn't stand it.
My experience has certainly been that since I started seeking out my own health and how to maintain it, that I have remained a lot more healthy than I was when I was trying to get the NHS to sort it out for me. It seems to me that they're pretty good at, like you say, at trauma and at things that, you know, like what happened to you, and car crashes and things like that. But really, the rest of it, if they don't know too much about nutrition, and they don't know too much about hydration, and they don't know too much about the immune system, then you're going to be doing yourself a lot of favours by going and talking to people who do understand those things.
Oh, and if you trail in and out of the hospital enough, you'd probably be sicker.
For sure. Yeah, I think that's the case.
You get so fouled up with those drugs, it's almost like taking in toxic compounds, and the people live on a cocktail of these things, and I say, you know, one feeds the other, it becomes a crazy situation. So, but, you know, so be it. Sometimes they get the mixture right, and some people seem to be happy, and they're certainly keeping certain crocs going, which might not have been able to keep going. But I still feel it's lovely. Like, you hear little stories in one of the nutritional cards I went to about this old girl that, well, she was old at the time. She was just retired nurse. She retired early because she had a bit of ill health herself. But she used to go, she was a spinster, and she didn't have family, so she used to do, the church was a lovely environment for her to have people around her and give it to new service community type thing. So she used to go regularly, and one day she was there and there was a speaker, and he was talking about exercise and how good it was for health and so on, and that everybody given enough training can run, and that is the sort of gist of it. So at the end of it, she went and said to him, look, you know, I'm basically pretty much crippled with the problems that I've got. And so, you know, you made this outrageous statement, you could get anybody to run. Could you get somebody like me to run? And he said, of course. It just requires time and patience and you to get to cooperate with advice. So she said, okay, come on, you know, I've got a bit of savings and I can probably pay you to do it if it's not too exorbitant. He said, oh, I think that'd be quite a challenge, you see. So he took her on, and she became the marathon granny, because at the age of 80-odd, she was still running marathons, and probably walking them, but, you know, and she ran at least 2 or 3 marathons a year. So he transformed it.
Just goes to show what can be done. I think that's probably a very good place to leave it, Stuart, because we're sort of 10, 15 minutes away from the end of the show, a few tunes. So, I've really enjoyed that. I think the people in the chat box have as well, found it very useful. I guess we should mention as well that you two are going to be presenting at the Conscious Tribal Gathering in North Wales, kind of later in the year. I'm looking forward to seeing you there.
Good, me too, Ed. We'd love to meet in person. And we'll take it from there, you know, and it should be a fun event.
Yeah, I reckon. So thanks very much once again for coming on and giving of your time. It's been a very useful talk. I'll just put some tunes on for the people out there, and just come and join you on Skype before we hang up. So here comes a bit of Kidnap Alice for those of you out there who are still out there listening, or will be in a moment when I can get it to play. Well, there you go. That's about it for another show. Thanks a lot to Stuart Ferraris for coming on and talking to us from the Beaumaris Dental Centre. I'll post his website address once more before I leave. Few more tunes to play on the way out. Going to hear a bit of AC/DC, bit of Motorhead. Also, a bit more Election Day celebration from Cassette Boy, one of his raps called The Emperor's New Clothes, and a little bit of Clark and Dawe on the way out. I'll be back with you next week when hopefully I'll be talking with Chris Evans, who has been for some years now using permacultural techniques to transform the lives of people, or more accurately, to help people transform their own lives in the extremely poor lands of Nepal, which is, of course, quite a topical place at the moment, having had some landslides and an earthquake and all of that. But we'll be hearing from Chris about the work he's doing over here in the lands of Albion and over in the Himalayas. So that's Dr. Rock's radio show next Thursday, of course, at 9 o'clock, with Chris Evans talking about permaculture. In the meantime, thanks as usual to PIR for being here and for letting me be here, and thanks most of all to all of you guys for being out there and listening. Keep up the good work. I'm sure that nothing major is changing out there. It's all just the same old shit in it. Anyway, here we go. AC/DC, big balls. That's what it is. It's just a bunch of big balls.